This edition of Aperitivo is first broadcast on the 15th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo is brought to you in association with the Glenlivet. Hello and welcome to a special edition of Aperitivo, coming to you live from the second edition of the Frieze Masters Art Fair in London's Regent Park. I'm Robert Bound. On today's show, we'll be sorting the Bruegels from the Gargoyles, asking how you put a price on a masterpiece, aren't they meant to be priceless, and all that jazz. We're going to speak to the curator of Vienna's Kunsthistorisches Museum, who will be curating the talks at Frieze Masters.
Every year that we live, we move one year further away from the times in which these collections were collected and created. And I've listened to historical curators, experts of kind of medieval and they're often not the best ambassadors for making historical art relevant.
That's Jasper Sharp, curator of Frieze Talks. He'll be telling me why he feels like a fairy godfather arranging blind dates between living artists and august institutions. I'll also sit down with collector and art advisor Kenny Schachter and Ben Luke, art critic for London's Evening Standard, to talk themes, sales, highlights, market, you name it. And we'll speak to Ossian Ward from the Listen Gallery about his booth's ballsy showing of a single artist, Richard Long. And we'll play some Morrissey, speak to the ever sprightly James Brett of the Gallery of everything about what he's brought to the fair, and we'll find something sparkling to wash it all down with. It's a beautiful thing, a packed special edition of our 6 o'clock show with me, Robert Bounds, live at Frieze Masters in London. Why don't you all come up and see my etchings? But first, of course, we're going back to Midori House. It's news time with Jonathan Wheatley.
The White House has just rejected a proposal from House of Representatives Republicans to extend the debt limit and reopen the federal government. The White House objected to the House's proposed alterations to President Barack Obama's Obamacare health law. Well, Thomas Mann from the Brookings Institute spoke earlier to Monocle's Emma Nelson and said he felt the shutdown had now reached a comical Seinfeld crisis about nothing.
You will see this was a Seinfeld crisis about nothing, and the solution will be about nothing. We will extend the debt ceiling to February. We'll extend the funding of government to January. Between now and then, we'll try to reach some agreement.
Iran said it presented what it called a logical proposal in talks with six world powers on Tuesday, aimed at achieving a breakthrough in a decade-old standoff over its contested nuclear program. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, represents the so-called P5+1 nations of the United States, Russia, China, France, Britain and Germany. Well, she said she was hoping for a productive 2 days.
I was very pleased that we agreed to come to Geneva with Minister Zarif and his team to continue the discussions. I hope that what we'll have here is a very productive 2 days, an opportunity to explore both the proposals that we have put on the table, but also ideas that are coming from Iran. We come here with cautious optimism, but a real sense of determination.
Italian government officials and humanitarian organisations met in Rome today to discuss the migrant issue. So far, 370 people have been plucked from the sea as the Operation Mare Nostrum got underway. The Italian Prime Minister Enrico Letta met his Finnish counterpart Jyrki Kaitinen in Rome, who pledged to help with ships and logistical aid.
We might have some vessels and know-how and personnel to send to the Mediterranean region, and we are just assessing our capacity, which could be used.
The German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservatives entered a second round of talks with the Greens to determine whether they can launch formal coalition negotiations. The parties have been sworn enemies ever since the environmentalists emerged as a political force back in the 1980s. In India, a total of 15 people were killed from Cyclone Felin. The low number of casualties stands in contrast to the 10,000 killed by Odisha's last big cyclone in 1999. The storm has now died down over Nepal. Chief Minister Navin Patnaik said restoring power supplies remained a concern.
So we are concentrating on necessary relief materials, food and medical supplies, which are reaching the people. Roads have been more or less fixed. Power will take some time in certain places, but there's been a great deal of damage done to the electrical works.
And staying in India, the government there is digging for treasure after a civic-minded Hindu village sage dreamt that 1,000 tons of gold were buried under a ruined palace and wrote to tell the central bank about it. A team of archaeologists has been sent to the village of Dundia Khera in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh. They are due to start digging on Friday. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
And you are listening to a very special edition of Aperitivo. We're coming to you live from the Frieze Masters Art Fair in London. It's Monocle 24, and we're going to be back with you in a second.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, this is Monocle 24.
Ut London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It sure is Monocle 24. This is Aperitivo. We're coming to you live from the Frieze Masters Art Fair in London. We're going to give you a time check. It's 18:06 here in London. Which either side of the park you are, whether you're the Camden side or whether you're the Baker Street side, it's 18:06. That makes it 13:06 in New York City. Joining me now to discuss what's hanging on the walls and how much it might cost is Ben Luke, art critic for London's Evening Standard newspaper. And alongside him is Kenny Schachter, art advisor and collector. Gentlemen, welcome to Aperitivo. Welcome
Thank
to Frieze Masters.
Thank you very much.
Thank I'm you saying welcome much. To Frieze Masters if it's my affair, as if I'm some sort of demented ringleader I'm thinking in sort of red breeches, a top hat. This is what I'm talking about. It's an art circus, right, we've come to. But it's a very classy art circus, isn't it? I think the exhibitors are allowed to choose from maybe 5 shades of grey for their booths and from the carpet. So despite the subtlety of the fair, and I'll come to you first, Ben, there's obviously some lovely things. What's jumped out off the walls at you so far on your tour this afternoon?
I think there's a couple of things which have really stood out, which are stands where people have gone with one artist. So we have a stand, Thomas Gibson's stand is full of Matisse, so there's 20 Matisse drawings, which are gorgeous, and lots of different media. That's wonderful. You also have Mnuchin, that you've got a whole stand of de Koonings. You've got, you know, when you go with one artist, you know there's going to be a sort of cohesion about your stand, and therefore, you know, those really do stand out. And also those where the contemporary and the historical are brought together in quite sort of jarring and often really effective juxtapositions.
Juxtaposition, I've got the bell for buzzwords.
Uh-huh.
Juxtaposition is a good one. No, yeah. We wonder what the bell for. When I got the bell out of my bag, your guys were going, what on earth are you doing with that, Rob? That's what it's for. But you're right, it's nice to see where the ancient and modern collide sometimes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes that happens by accident. You know, one point I was walking down one of the aisles and there was a Constable sketch, and I turned round and there was some Onkawara, very conceptual painting. So those kind of unexpected bits of time travel that you do as well, yeah. I really enjoy that. It's because, you know, the fact is art fairs, a procession of booths can get terribly monotonous. And I think one of the things about Frieze Masters is that it keeps it active by having this incredible balance between the very ancient and the very modern.
And Kenny, what's kind of jumped out at you? Do you kind of dig this thing, the kind of conversation with some of the older pieces and some of the more, well, modern, not contemporary, but modern pieces?
Well, I mean, I think there is a mixture of contemporary and modern. I have to say, I haven't really gotten around the fair much. If it wasn't for you guys, I wouldn't...
Yeah, we kind of hijacked your time. Sorry about that.
Well, no, I wouldn't
have even... ask you a question you know the answer to.
I wouldn't have even been able to get in because they have a hierarchy with the passes, and there's an 11 a.m. pass for the VIPs,
yeah,
and then that's the VVIP, and then there's a 2 p.m. pass. So there's a kind of a hierarchical structure according to who they let in, and I didn't make the first draft, so I was only slated for the second draft, but thanks for smuggling me in.
We smuggled you in. We kind of got you through. We had to dress you up as a chef, didn't we, to get you in, as a catering staff.
An art handler, moving in. But I did, I have to say, in the one booth that I did stick my head in, there's a piece that actually references a head. It's by an American, African-American artist called David Hammons. And he's a very enigmatic artist that sort of comes in and out of the radar of the contemporary art world. And it's interesting as well that you've mentioned prices, because there's a rock, and affixed to the top of the rock, glued, are little hairs, individual pieces of an afro hair that reference the human head, and it's standing on a piece of an iron plinth. And I remember maybe about 15 years ago that I fell in love with one from this very series of works, and it was at the price of $15,000. And I just recoiled when I asked the price of the piece a mere 15 years later, and ready for this, $2.3 million.
Man, I like that.
I felt like stoning myself.
Rolling stones don't gather moss, but if you keep them standing still, they can accrue up to $2.5 million in profit.
There you go.
That's a nice fact, right? It is a kind of funny thing. Obviously, it's sort of easy to forget you're at a fair sometimes when you're kind of I'm looking across here at Blunker Gallery, at Bruce Silverstein. These are some beautiful things. Just to give our listeners kind of a taste of what we're looking at, we're looking straight into a booth with quite conceptual modern sculptures. To our left, we've got altar pieces and things, which I wouldn't use the word nicked. But they were once in a church, weren't they? So there's such to give our listeners an idea of the breadth of what we can see around us. How on earth, I'll come to you, Ben, how on earth do you choose a sort of hierarchy of maybe the quality of the work? And how do you put a price on this stuff?
It's a terrible... of course, there are sort of market forces which help you decide this. But I think especially when you're seeing things in this... again, the ancient and modern in close contact, it becomes such an interesting study in what is value. You know, around us we've got, I'm sure, a small Donald Judd sculpture made 50 years ago would be worth a hell of a lot more than a 12th century lion from Italy. So you do get you get a very, very vexed scenario. But of course, I think that's part of the fun of it is, you know, walking around the fair, seeing things that you admire, and then thinking, well, you know, how does that fit in with the market? Who's, you know, and then, of course, some of the stands are using the sort of orange dots still. You know, it's very sort of old-fashioned way of doing it.
That's pretty old school, Kenny, right? When was the last time you saw
that? I would say it's a bit cheesy at this point in time.
You've just got one in your jacket. I'm only joking. But it is. It's an old school thing, isn't it? I mean, I just wonder, both of your times visiting the fairs, has the style of them changed? We're veering off into the general with this question, I think, a bit. But I wonder whether you feel that they've got more tightly curated, that the selling has got more subtle. We were talking about the lack of orange dots. I mean, that does seem like our local art gallery that's selling watercolors maybe is doing that, right?
I mean, I think ultimately this is a trade fair. Let's call it what it is. It's really a commercial trade fair. Of course, the art world likes to cloak it with all of these other aesthetic and sort of curatorial and aesthetic attributes. But really, these are about people laying out a blanket on the street in a bazaar to sell their goods, and that's what it is. So it has all these other airs that are almost manufactured to make it appear somehow transcendent other than a typical commercial marketplace, which is what it is. So it's an extraordinary, for me, it's a very easy and comfortable way to stroll up and down these wide aisles and see great art. I think there's been... it's an interesting, when you compare the contemporary to this kind of more traditional and more market accepted and embraced paintings and sculptures, it's a very interesting dichotomy. And if you go to Frieze, I mean, I always say half flippantly that 90% of the things within the tent of the contemporary version of this fair could and very well be worthless in about 5 years' time. Maybe 75%, I'm being a little bit too harsh.
You're talking about the contemporary fair.
Very much.
Works that were made for the fair by contemporary artists.
And I think in a certain respect, I mean, people's expectations are different about what they're looking for to augment. Some people collect in a very nichified way, only contemporary and more traditional. But it's really a bell's curve of quality and pricing points. So I'm sure there are things even here that are a few thousand pounds and they go up to millions, but... for me, it's just a great place to experience a broad cross-section of material in the easiest context, which is under one roof, which makes it a very pleasant experience.
And there's an idea that you don't necessarily get so much at the contemporary fair, or the contemporary fairs, Frieze and its competitors, that here there is stuff that was in people's houses, because it is old stuff. There's an element of decorative arts to a lot of this stuff, rather than telling a story, soul-searching, maybe some of the preoccupations of contemporary art. A lot of this stuff stuff is just unashamed to be beautiful, right? So it's a nice place to be for that. Trade fair, as Kenny says, or not, right? It's a very beautiful place to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of work, which, I mean, one of the great things about works that are historical is that very often right next to them you've got the provenance and you see the ancestral, the aristocratic chain that forms the background to the paintings. And of course, the fact is that when you are in these kind of very, very beautiful spaces for an art fair, I mean, this is, you know, you have to remember that art fairs are generally pretty unpleasant places to be. They're pretty hot, they're pretty packed, there's lots of people around.
Quite a cold corner here, actually.
Yeah, no, exactly. Quite a cold corner here.
I brought my collar stand up here. You know?
But the spaces in the aisles here, it's so sedate compared to most art fairs. And I think that's, you know, going back to the original question, that idea of how art fairs have shifted. You know, this feels like a much more sophisticated art fair than any that I've been to. And it feels like the pace is slightly slower as well than the contemporary fairs. And I think that, you know, the injection of a kind of historical work into this fair means that it gives that sort of different atmosphere.
And I guess the works, you know, as I said, surrounded by stuff that's got such a patina about it, such an age or sort of quality that sort of lasted through the years, is something that kind of slows the pace of most of the viewers down. There is something, I suppose, we'll test this out tomorrow when we walk through the park. We walk through the fallen leaves. Should we paint a romantic picture for our listeners? We walk through the fallen leaves southwards to the Fries Contemporary Fair, which does seem a lot more frenetic. It's got a different energy to it. The materials that they used in the tent itself are a lot more are echoey, maybe. You know, this is all very soft carpet and stuff. That's kind of part of selling the dream, right, Kenny?
I mean, in a sense, you could say that the contemporary sector these days has a shorter attention span than the people that congregate the halls here. And really, like you said, contemporary art is a very fast-paced world, and the prices are changing, and people's tastes are changing. I almost see it as like an instant history and a meta market where the jury is no longer out. People are just making such rapid and quick determinations, and people are buying art in the contemporary context, I would say, using something other than their eyes, and that's the ear. Because really, the whispers and conversations drive the contemporary market more than kind of art is a slow-burning process, and it needs a lot of time to, like you say, there's very significant historical material here that needs a connoisseurship, which in the contemporary art world seems to be no longer of use to any of the people that are the main participants in this field. They're buying, they're selling, making instant judgments without really processing the information in a meaningful way.
And I'm guessing that a lot of the stuff here, in fact, we know that a lot of the stuff here is proven it's good. You know, it's proven it's worth something, and it's worth an actual amount of money rather than, it's not like a stock or a share, right? Most of this stuff is sort of probably worth what it is, and it has been. Maybe the prices haven't fluctuated so much with this stuff.
Well, I mean, we live in a market today where there are very rapid fluctuations in all categories of work. So, of course, not in old masters are lagging contemporary and modern, but I would say for classic contemporary. I mean, if you look at some of the recent prices at auction and some of the pieces coming up this week at both Christie's and Sotheby's and also Phillips in addition, which is more contemporary. But I would say we live in a land of rapid price movements today where there could be changes from one quarter to the next of 100, 200, 300% nowadays.
We are at Fries Masters. We're talking market. We're talking also a lot of the beautiful things around us. I'm joined by Ben Luke from London's Evening Standard and Kenny Schachter, art advisor and collector. We're going to take a little short break. We're going to take a little break. It's all right. We're going to cheers. We can chink our glasses now, gentlemen. We'll be back with you in a second.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whiskey connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whiskey. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
And you are back with me, Robert Bounds, at Frieze Masters Art Fair in London's Regent Park. This is a special edition of Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. I'm joined by Ben Luke from London's Evening Standard and Kenny Schachter, art advisor and collector. We've been shooting the breeze about how much things cost, about how comfy the carpets are, about how keen the air conditioning is in this corner of the art fair. But first, I made a foray out into the fair a little bit earlier on. And I spoke to someone from a gallery which has put up one of their most ballsy booths, perhaps. It's a solo show, a single artist presentation. Richard Long at the Listen Gallery. And I spoke to Ossian Ward a little bit earlier.
Hi, I'm Ossian Ward. I'm head of content at the Listen Gallery.
And we're standing underneath, well, in a sort of very beautiful minimal stand here at Listen, Ossian. Richard Long, two Richard Long works. Beating the sort of the mean number of works on a stand, just keeping the average low. Most people have 20 or 30 bits and bobs, but you've kept it very clean. Why is that? What are you showing us?
Well, there's actually three works. There's a text work on the wall, and
just waiting for you to spot that.
Well, and we've got some other things in the back, but you know, these major works are a monumental stone piece from 1991, made out of onyx stone, which is this kind of beautiful pale stone that Richard discovered while walking, obviously, as Richard does a lot of walking in Portugal. He discovered this stone, so there's a lovely big rectangle of this stone on the floor, and then on the wall behind us there's a mud piece, or it's actually clay. He usually works with mud from the Avon River because he's a Bristolian and it works with his local mud, but I think this clay is slightly lighter in color and it's on a black wall, so it kind of shows up, and he's remade this piece, splashing and painting and using his fingers to create what's called a muddy water circle.
And there's a sort of such an energy to these works. There's a lot of sort of old stuff on a lot of these booths here at Frieze Masters. This stuff, obviously, it's remade every time it's re-erected, despite the fact that they're old works, maybe 20 years old as works. They get sort of reapplied, don't they? Remade. How does that work when you're cataloguing them, for example, to decide how old these works really are?
Well, he first made the wall piece in 1994, and then each time it gets remade and this has been sold at the fair, it will then be wiped and he'll have to go and recreate it. And I mean, the stone pieces, they are crated up and then remade, but remade differently every time because you can't really position the stones in exactly the same configuration, so it's always new. So they are obviously sort of very contemporary in each of their makings, but we want to try and look at Richard as a classic 1960s kind of conceptual artist. It's all about the text, it's all about the words, it's all about his performance, rather than we sometimes think of him as being a land artist who makes things in the landscape, but very often he'll go out into the landscape, make a line of stones or make a path that he's made along one of his walks, and no one will ever experience it, or they might see it in a photograph, but he will just leave something in the landscape and then it will disappear. So for him, these are obviously permanent or semi-permanent works, but his practice is very conceptual. It's not really, it's about him being out in the world, making his walk, and then occasionally bringing some stuff back into the gallery.
And there's an old school lack of commerciality to that artistic instinct, isn't there, of going out and making stuff. And if you're an artist, if you're a well-known artist, the stuff you make, without wanting to do Monty Python's joke about letters to the milkman, the stuff you make is worth money. So, and there's something about that to the idea, to the way you've put the gallery together, you guys that listen. The fact that there's only two pieces, and they're difficult to own, aren't they, these pieces of art?
Yeah, no, they require the same kind of commitment I think it takes to make the work in the first place. Richard is so committed to his walks, to his practice. You know, he is just an itinerant guy. He just travels around the world making these things. And for someone to want to own one, yes, it's difficult, but they can be left outdoors, these big stone pieces. So to some extent, you know, they are desirable, but it's not like buying a painting or buying something that you can fit in your home. These works require space. They require commitment from a collector or from an institution. But, you know, he does make smaller pieces as well. But I think that's why we look at him as a conceptual artist rather than as a land artist.
And is there something to do with the vibe of Frieze Masters maybe that allows you to do this? I wonder how far in advance you decide to... I know at Frieze Contemporary down the road at the other fair, which we're going to be reporting on tomorrow, you've got a Dan Graham Pavilion, another single artist show. It's quite a gutsy move for a commercial gallery, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you said that it was something about seeing too many things. Fairs can be exhausting and there can be hundreds of works on show. We've decided to keep it simple, make big presentations of our artists. Our gallery is nearby, so if people want to come to the galleries and see more things, they can. But I feel like at the fair, you need to slightly change it up. You need to mix it up and showcase something that you believe in rather than just doing a fair booth. So, you know, we've gone strong this year and two of our kind of heavyweight artists.
Shall we end on a pun, do you think, Ossian? Do you want to what do you want to describe Richard Long as?
I thought of another one, but you do it.
Let's call him a rock star. Ossian, thanks very much.
Thanks.
And that was me talking to Ossian Ward of London's Listen Gallery about their booth here at Frieze Masters, which is a solo presentation from Richard Long. Three works, gentlemen. I'm joined, by the way, by Ben Luke from London's Evening Standard and Kenny Schachter, art advisor and critic, and an advisor and collector. There's many, many adjectives for Kenny. How ballsy is it for a booth just to show one artist three works? There's one major work, you might say, but three works by one artist, Ben. It's sort of a trend. And I know down at the Contemporary Fair, there's a place where you can only do solo shows. It's for young galleries and things. How gutsy is it?
I think it is very gutsy, but it's also, I mean, it's a stunning booth. It has to be said. It's one of the absolute highlights of the whole fair. So in that sense, Listen have done very well. They've got themselves noticed. I think it's very smart. I mean, they may sell all three of those works, but it's also an advertisement. It's you know, they're working with Richard Long again after a period of a very long time.
Yeah, he was with them in the 60s, he's come back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he's been at other galleries and now he's back with Listen. So it's a massive statement. And it's incredibly confident. And of course, Richard Long has made lots of other works, and so if you can't buy these three works here at the fair, then I'm sure they have others.
What do you think about it, Kenny? Because there's also a trend for non-selling shows by commercial galleries. I mean, Haus & Werth, for example, are doing non-selling show outside the fair right now. Is this a sort of a curatorial statement, or are they playing the long market game?
They're playing. Period. I mean, I'm a slightly more cynical, so I would beg to politely disagree. And I don't think there's any ballsy thing about it. I mean, everyone in it's a feeding frenzy of people trying to distinguish themselves and create a unique kind of position in the market. So Listen has Anish Kapoor, and they have a lot of Ai Weiwei and a lot of market leading contemporary artists. So to do something like this, again, it's a marketing ploy, and they're just trying to distinguish themselves from the competition at hand. So I mean, I think they're incredible, interesting moves, but the whole notion of these quasi-historical museum-type exhibitions put on by commercial galleries, again, it's a complete ruse. I mean, if you ask, first of all, there's no such thing as a show where everything is not for sale. It's BS, if you ask me, or a bit of bollocks, as you guys would say. It's just not the case, because everything is not for sale until you come up with an offer to the dealer, and all of a sudden, lo and behold, something gets unstuck from the not for sale show. So I don't really believe it. And again, it's just trying to say that this one gallery, I won't mention any names that you mentioned about 5 minutes ago, they have three monstrous spaces in the City of London, and they're trying to bang their hands on their chest and say, we're a commercial gallery flouting the whole notion of capitalism by showing a non-selling show, giving a big two fingers to the world of museums and commercial institutions. And I don't buy it for a second, because pretty much I'm sure someone should do an undercover investigation and ask about 10 pieces what could be bought out of some of these allegedly not selling shows. Again, I mean, I think it's a beautiful gesture, and I certainly wouldn't take anything away from it aesthetically. But again, you have to see what they're up against and why they would be moved to do something like this. There's certainly no altruism floating around in the booths of this art fair that we're in right now.
Kenny Schachter, he talks a mean game, doesn't he, Ben Luke?
Right. Listen,
this is a great booking right here. This is great radio. We've got these two guys, two very nice guys, slightly hammering tongs with each other. The beauty versus the curator. I don't know whether the market and the beauty where it overlaps, I suppose. We kind of come to the end of our allotted half hour at the beginning of this show with you two. So I want to ask you, if you could buy or steal something from the walls that you've seen so far, what would it be? Let's say buy. Come on, why are we always inciting criminality here?
I have no idea how much it will cost me, but there is an absolutely stunning Joan Mitchell painting. Vast diptych. Abstract diptych, and I think that's an absolutely gorgeous painting.
That's
so that
what
would
Ben's
be my choice.
Going to be hanging in his bathroom. Kenny, what's on your shopping list?
As I said, I've just been smuggled in here illicitly. I'll have to put some camouflage under my eyes and serpentine along the aisles to avoid detection, but I haven't been around enough, I'm sure going to be, and I've seen a Jean-Michel Basquiat, I've seen a beautiful Richard Prince painting, and in terms of these kinds of artists, the contemporary artists that are looking very undervalued in relationship to some of the younger stuff that's in the tents across the park, and it's an interesting world that we live in now.
For my money, I'm gonna take that Bruegel back to Africa, right? The one that's on Johnny Van Heften's stand. You don't get too many new Bruegels popping out of the woodwork, do you? So that maybe is the one to take. I'm going to thank you both, Ben Luke from London's Evening Standard and Kenny Schachter, art advisor and collector, for joining me for this first half of our special aperitivo, coming to you live from Frieze Masters in Regent's Park in London. How many qualifiers can I put in that sentence?
You do it breathlessly.
That's what I've got the bell for, to give myself a breather. There is plenty still to come in the second half of today's Aperitivo. We'll be catching up with the director of Frieze Masters, Victoria Siddle, and we'll be talking to James Brett from the Gallery of Everything. But before we get started on that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Rob, thanks very much. The White House has just rejected a proposal from the House of Representatives Republicans to extend the debt limit and reopen the federal government. The White House objected to the House's proposed alterations to President Barack Obama's Obamacare health law. Iran said it presented what it called a logical proposal in talks with six world powers today in Geneva, aimed at achieving a breakthrough in the decade-old standoff over its contested nuclear program. Italian government officials and humanitarian organizations have met in the Italian capital, Rome, today to discuss the migrant issue. So far, 370 people have been plucked from the sea as the Operation Mare Nostrum got underway. And the German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservatives entered a second round of talks with the Greens to determine whether they could launch formal coalition negotiations. It could be difficult, as the parties have been sworn enemies ever since the environmentalists emerged as a political force back in the 1980s. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and welcome back to a special edition of Aperitivo. We're coming to you live from Frieze Masters in London's Regent Park. I'll give you a little bit of a time update. It's 18:32 here in London. That's making it 21:32 in Moscow and 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. I wonder how many Brazilian galleries there are here today. I don't think there are any. I think there may be a couple down at Contemporary, where we're going to be tomorrow, shooting the breeze with some more great guests. We're going to have Victoria Siddle, but she's wandered off. We've got some people on the lookout for her. What we're going to do instead is play an interview with Jasper Sharp. I chatted to him earlier today here under the tent. I talked to, he's the curator of Frieze Talks. He's the curator of modern and contemporary art at Vienna's Kunsthistorisches Museum, the name I failed to pronounce properly in the menu to this program earlier. And he talked to us about how to put art, old art, under the spotlight of new eyes. And here he is. This is Jasper Sharp. Jasper, welcome to our Aperitivo special coming from Frieze Masters. Your neck of the woods is directly behind us in the lecture theatre. Sounds quite official, doesn't
Sounds
it?
Sounds very official.
Sounds very official. Sorry.
I've never seen my name up on a wall before, quite like this, before either.
It's in a handsome font. It's white on grey. This is how we roll here, right? This is part of the colour scheme. We always talk about so much of art practice and art writing and curators and artists themselves talk about creating a dialogue. This is precisely
discourse, dialogue. Yeah.
Jasper's rolling his eyes at that. Presumably this is part of what you're doing, but you're actually talking about stuff, about the concerns of artists, about themes. What are you going to be riffing on in the talk series?
I mean, it really comes from the fact that I've got a slightly difficult job. I work in a museum in Vienna whose collection comes to a sort of grinding halt in 1800. And, you know, the National Gallery comes to a grinding halt in 1900, the Louvre in 1850, the Prado, Hermitage. And every year that we live, we move 1 year further away from the times in which these collections were collected and created. And I've listened to historical curators, experts of kind of medieval and Renaissance, and they're often not the best ambassadors for making historical art relevant to us today. And actually, I've found that in my experience, living artists are actually far more articulate defenders. I mean, it's as if old art needs defending, but they're sort of more articulate sort of exponents and ambassadors for. So we had this idea, yeah, to put together artists with the directors of either historical museums or, in the case of LACMA, an encyclopedic museum, which is still collecting. And two of them are complete blind dates. I mean, on tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, Beatrice Milhaz meets Martin Roth at the V&A.
Will there be like a glittery curtain that is drawn aside and then we'll see how they get on next week?
Yeah, exactly. No, like the next day.
It's on
Thursday. So that'll be very fresh.
Yeah.
And Beatrice, you know, we asked all of them to choose their museum, basically, except Richard. He got bunked with me. He didn't have a choice. But the others all chose their museums. And, John Curran choosing the National Gallery was kind of interesting. Yeah. Kathy chose LACMA, which is her local museum.
Yeah. Yeah.
Chose her local museum, which she said, you know, has been my library for my lifetime. So that'll be very interesting. They know each other very well, which can go both ways. That can be incredibly tedious with two people who know each other so well, or it can be amazing. Mm. So we had one last year with two people who knew each other very well, and I was sort of umming and ahhing at the back of the auditorium saying, I wish these people didn't actually know each other. So we got two blind dates, Beatrice and Martin Roth, and then John Curran and the National Gallery. So for me, those are the ones to kind of really look out for.
Yeah.
But Kathy and Michael, you know.
That'd be good. Yeah. Exactly. We'll hope that they won't just be discussing what they did last night on their shopping list.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you also about we're in a tent in Regent's Park. As handsome as it is, it's a selling place.
Sure. Although my favourite thing that I found here isn't for sale. I've chosen the one thing that's not for sale, a beautiful little painting by Martin Barre from the 60s. And I just saw
someone it. Someone just had it under their arm?
No, I just walked in and it belongs to the widow and she's here and she's walking around and it's not for sale.
Right.
So I've chosen the only thing which isn't.
But how do the talks sort of filter into that? I mean, clearly people maybe talking about it with more of a depth than maybe the contemporary fair. Who knows? But where do the talks sort of fit into the whole thing?
I have to be completely honest here. I've always been a bit suspicious of these kind of programs that accompany art fairs. Because if they were about money in art or investment or art funds, I'd kind of think that they tie in a little bit more. So I often feel that, you know, I've always been a little bit sort of ambiguous about, A, whether they're necessary, and B, do they just try and add some academic luster to what is essentially a selling exhibition? In this case, we really did try to do something. And I've said to all of these artists, spend half a day walking through this fair, and I'm going to ask you at the end of every talk, can you actually give me your kind of shopping list of things that you would be taking? So I'm also keen to see how they, you know, operate in the fair. I think we're trying to just see... the interesting thing is, you know, I've had a long conversation with Richard Wright last night about our talk, and he sent me his slide list, and it goes from Fra Angelico to Mondrian. And it's going to be quite a kind of, you know, it's going to be sort of 40 minutes through 2,000 years or, you know, certainly 1,000 years. And it's going to be kind of put your seatbelts on.
That's speed archaeology.
Yeah, basically, yeah. speed art dating or something.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Jasper Sharp, thank you very much for talking us through. We wish you the best of luck from tomorrow onwards, I think,
I've got very little to do. I just introduced.
With you making sure everyone's put on their aftershave and brushed their teeth before their artistic blind dates. Jasper, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And that was me catching up with Jasper Sharp a little bit earlier. He's the boss of the Frieze Masters Talks here, where they shine contemporary light on old paintings. And now I'm joined by Victoria Siddle, who's the director of Frieze Masters. Hi, boss.
Hi.
I noticed ago we offered you water or wine, and you chose water, so I guess you're still working, right?
That's true, yeah.
Uh-oh.
I mean, the fair is technically still open. So.
I guess it is, isn't it? Look at all these people. Look at all this stuff
going on. It's full
of
people, you know.
Well, listen, thank you for your time, because I know this is kind of the part where you are kind of pulled in 57,000 different directions.
This is the exciting bit.
So it's nice to have you here. I asked you this before we turn the microphones on, but I kind of want to ask you again, actually, whether this is a bit of a point where you can relax and kind of be vaguely sociable, or whether it's still a bit bananas.
it's a bit bananas just because this is, you know, we worked towards this the entire year.
Yeah.
And then the doors opened at 3 o'clock, which is only, you know, sort of 3.5 hours ago. and so it's still kind of reeling from people coming in and seeing their reactions to it. And it, which is kind of, that's the exciting bit. Like, the galleries have worked so hard to bring amazing works. It's all beautifully installed. The architecture looks great. And this is when people, this is like the moment of truth, when people come in and they're actually seeing it and responding to it for the first time.
This is the eating of the pudding, and which is the proof.
In which is the proof, exactly.
Yeah. And what's the vibe? I mean, it's we're only 3.5 hours old, but there seems to be a good humour under this canvas this year, right?
It's
you
very
have
good
a, you have
atmosphere.
A year and then you kind of have the second year and everyone gets a bit more buoyed up, maybe, I don't
it's
know.
It's a different feeling in a way, because I think last year people just had no idea what to expect, me included. and I think for the exhibitors too, you know, and a lot of them bought extraordinary things last year and everyone said the quality was great, but it was essentially a surprise for everybody walking in and no one knew what exactly to make of it, I suppose. Whereas this year, the exhibitors knew what the fair was going to be. They've brought work accordingly, and it's, you know, fantastically high quality. There's all these great curated stands, single artist presentations.
Yeah, we were just talking about Lilith and Richard Long rocks, and it's a beautiful thing. It's kind of it's things like that really stand out. And I suppose the way that you curate the fair, you direct it, you tell people where to sit. You know, that gives a rhythm to the booth and to how you view the thing, presumably, right?
Yeah. So I think there's certainly a lot more people here than last year as well. That was quite noticeable when we opened the doors.
Yeah, you're like, oh, hi.
Big queue of people outside.
Is that the thing where you like throw a party and you're like, well, I'll invite too many people just in case, and then they all come?
And yes. I mean, it doesn't feel too busy. It's a good sort of atmosphere in here. It feels very nice.
It does.
Galleries mostly seem to be smiling, which is always a good sign.
That's okay. It's always nice to get invited in for a drink, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. That's always the thing. And how? And as the director of this fair, how much say do you have? What kind of conversations? And how early in the year do you have conversations about what people are going to show? Because I guess you're trying to, because there is such a historical breadth of work on sale here and on show here, that you want to get that balance right, don't you? You need to know that it's not all going to be old things that were in a church, or it's not all going to be modernist paintings, right?
Yeah, so we select the galleries from the scratch every single year. So every gallery applies in January, actually. It all happens very early. And a lot of them apply with specific proposals of what they would show. And then I have a selection committee who are locked in a room for 2 days until they've whittled the list down.
It sounds intense. It's like those it's dog training things. They have to jump through hoops of fire and things like that.
Yeah, right? More or less. And they then select, you know, we had over double the number of applications than we have spaces in the fair. Yeah. So we have to sort of cut that list down until we feel that we've got the best quality, but also the best range. So, you know, this year I was keen to bring in some things that were missing. So we have a stand this year of Shunga, some erotic Japanese prints. You know, we didn't have anything like that last year. So it's still about sort of, you know, making it as broad and interesting as possible.
And do you notice, I mean, do you notice themes in this? Obviously, maybe it's sort of easier to be thematic with the contemporary fair and notice things. You can extrapolate what people are doing, what kind of things people are bringing. Do you notice that here? We always kind of think, or a few years back, we thought that there were maybe more photographs for sale, more things that hung over the fireplace, more conservative things which reflected the lack of cash in people's pockets, maybe. Yeah. Do you notice themes in sort of ancient to modern art in the same way?
I think here in particular, people are doing kind of what I asked them to do, which is great, which is to think about...
we've actually made a stern face
then, sound
as well,
terribly
at me.
Bossy. which is, you know, to think about this fair differently to other historical fairs and to bring work that feels fresh and contemporary and relevant regardless of when it was made. And, you know, I think galleries really have thought about that. Like, what would appeal to a contemporary audience? Say, what might an artist look at and be excited about and be inspired by? And that's the kind of work we've tried to bring into the fair, so that people are making exciting discoveries, even though that work might have been made 500 years ago.
And I wonder how important the brand of Frieze is in all this as well, in kind of getting people that are familiar with and have bought. Maybe they're new collectors, and maybe they're youngish collectors, but they've been buying and happy to buy contemporary work. Suddenly they like the brand of Frieze.
Yeah.
Suddenly there's a master's fair. The people that were going to the contemporary fair are now coming to this and going, wow, why don't we get a 14th century Madonna instead of a Jeff Koons or instead of a Richard Prince?
As well as.
As well as. That's
as
what
well
you
as.
Want. That's okay.
As well as. Is that we want everything.
Yeah.
No, I think you're right. And I think the Frieze brand has been incredibly important in that, in the setup, in the first 2 years especially. Because one of the things we wanted to do with this, and I think I hope to an extent have succeeded in doing, is bring new audiences to historical art. And I would bet that most people here, or certainly most people who visit over the 5 days, have not been to an Old Master Fair before. You know, they are on the whole.
Because I guess that was always the domain of Tefaf in Maastricht. Mm. Very traditional, very beautiful fair, but very traditional. This is mixing it up a bit, and I guess you are. You can ferry people from one end of the park to another. It's a thing, right?
And also, for us, the starting point is contemporary, so it inevitably feels different to other fairs. The architecture is very modern and minimal. There aren't sections for old masters and modern and ancient. Everything's mixed, so we try to create these interesting juxtapositions within the fair between different periods of history. So I think that makes it feel quite fresh and exciting for people who might ordinarily just go to a contemporary fair.
Well, it's nice. It's that thing where you where you're not necessarily expecting these old works to be peering at you from kind of pretty modern grey walls. There's a nice piece of exhibition design about it. I did a story at the Rijksmuseum. I just saw Taco Dibbitz walk past. I love him. He's a dynamo of energy, isn't he?
He's amazing. He's on the advisory committee for Frieze Masters.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah, he was one of the earliest people I signed up.
He's a dude, because this kind of reminds me of some of the staging of those things. I think it's Wilmot is the exhibition designer. It's that beautiful thing of the gunmetal grey and then some of these beautiful gilt pieces against it. It's nice. Yeah. We're going to let you go off and... I guess going to get on with your job, really, still. She's still on the waters here. She's still working.
I am.
Victoria Siddle, director of Frieze Masters. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You're tuned in to Aperitivo. We're coming to you live from London's Regent Park at the Frieze Masters Art Fair. We're going to have a little short break. Then we're going to have an art-themed song. So stay with us.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavours of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. And every week in London, there's a rollerblading convoy that reclaims the streets for the pedestrians and pedal pushers. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week, Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
To me, placemaking is a sacred community process. It's about an organic way that communities can evolve and shape the spaces that are important to them.
Every 20 years, the city gets rebuilt. There's probably not a lot of cities in the world that gets rebuilt every 20 years.
People respond to variety, and cities need a richness and diversity.
Oh, and we take time to savour the softer side of metropolitan living too, from the need for playfulness to places to pause in the melee. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
And that was a promotional piece of material to talk about a show called The Turbanist, all about Indian headwear there, presented by Andrew Tuck. We are Aperitivo. I'm Robert Bounds. We're coming to you live from the Frieze Masters Art Fair in London. We've had some good cats on the show, some good bookings, I think. But we're going to take a little break now. We're going to have an art-related song. I'll do anything to crowbar this dude into a show. This is, to me, You Are a Work of Art by Morrissey.
I live the life, I feel the pain, to sing the song, to tell the tale.
And that was, to me, You're a Work of Art by Morrissey, who is not liked by my next guest. The director and owner of the Gallery of Everything, James Brett. Hi, James.
Hello, how are you?
I'm all right. Are you putting on that voice because you're wearing a bow tie?
Yes, I am. And I feel here in Frieze Masters I need to be a little posher than my normal self. You look amazing in your tails.
I know, thank you. I know you're not meant to wear a top hat inside, but I couldn't really keep my headphones on with any other item of headwear.
I think it's appropriate to the average age range here at Frieze Masters.
I don't think anyone... do you think anyone here went to school at a place where you didn't have to wear a top hat?
I don't think anyone here didn't get spanked a lot, and I think that's why their collections are so enormous. I'm sorry. We opened our bar about 15 minutes ago, and I'm the main visitor.
You're the main visitor to the bar.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
So let's talk about the Gallery of Everything.
Yes.
It's a beautiful place. It's got a depth to it, hasn't it? You'll have to lead us through it, and then we get to the bar at the back. There's some curtainage.
That's true.
It's a sort of curated booth with a nice happy ending.
Well, it's a 20-kilometer deep chasm in the middle of Frieze Masters. It's probably one of the smallest stands in the entire fair. But we decided early on, despite it being so small, a colleague of mine knew about Gagosian and the working methods there. He said, do all the deals in the back room. So we made 50% of our stand
the back room.
And whether or not it was a good idea, I don't know, but we've got a bar, we've got a giant artwork in there, and to get there you have to walk through this sort of maze of sculptures by this French artist called ACM, who's a sort of old boy now, who when I first started looking at this kind of alternative artworks and you know, what they call outsider artists, this chap turned up and I thought, great, he's got initials, ACM, phenomenal. And it means Alfred and Corinne Marier. And his wife is Corinne. She does all the talking and he does all the sculpting. And he takes old typewriters, radios, and he breaks them down and renews them, gives them new life. And they look like archaeologies or temples or jungles. And that's what you have to fight through in order to reach our bar.
And it's that's sort of like a holy grail.
Yeah.
You shouldn't sell it like that, James. These things are in glass cases. You do sort of have to slalom from the front of your stand to the back to get... Well, by the way, what have you been mixing in the back?
Oh, drink
wise. I'm not talking about moonshine. what's going on there? What could people enjoy?
Well, I mean, you know, look... I think what I should probably tell everybody listening in case they don't know is, you know, the Gallery of Everything is something we started to support the Museum of Everything, which is a charity and which is the thing that I run, which shows artists who are not necessarily artists or don't call themselves
as such. Yeah, let's define outsider art for our
listeners. You know, in the art newspaper today, there's a big thing, says outsiders coming in, and there's nothing journalists like more than using the words out and in with outsiders. But actually what you're really talking about is people making art without talking about themselves as artists. And I'm very interested in it. And after three or so years of going around the globe, with the support of Monocle and Monocle Radio, we've got a big audience and people are looking at it. And this year in the Venice Biennale, there was a lot of it. It was all over.
Which one of your artists, someone's just literally stuck their tongue at me. That's Olivier.
That was Olivier Varenne.
Olivier Varenne, a curator.
A notorious
and rude
tongue.
Man.
Notorious tongue.
Who have you seen? When was the last time someone kind of had a go at you by putting their thumb to their nose and waggling their fingers?
Every time I have a board meeting, because the board of the Museum of Everything, called the Board of Everything, is average age 6. the artist that we're showing in Frieze Masters, who was in the Biennale, is Anna Zemankova.
Yeah.
Who was a Czech artist who started making these strange emotional drawings in her mid-50s, encouraged by her son, who was a sculptor. She was collected by Václav Havel, by Jan Švankmajer, but people really don't know her. And it was Massimiliano Gioni who put her in a show at the New Museum and then gave her her own room at the Venice Biennale. So we spoke to the family and said, you know, we'd really like to show her at Frieze Masters because she really is a classic representative of someone who's making art because they have to. Mm. They've got something they want to communicate, and it doesn't have to be called art, but we know that it is. And
does that sort of fit into the vernacular of Frieze Masters here, when there are things that were decorative, there are things that were religious, there were things that didn't know they were art when they were made, but they've become art because maybe they're in this tent, you know, maybe because they're in a gallery. Is that sort of part and parcel of what you're doing as well with showing these artists in your booth?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, right next to where we've got our bar, which is in tended to encourage such discourse. We were showing some of the films from the Salon of Everything that we had in Venice, which is artists, curators, thinkers talking about, well, actually, what's happening when people are making art? What are these objects? And sure, if you walk in Main Frieze, a lot of ideas, a lot of conceptual art, but talk to someone like Roberta Smith in New York, yeah, and she'll tell you conceptual art killed art, in so many words, because the art-making practices became more and more cerebral and less actual and physical. So in some ways, the artist who doesn't consider themselves an artist is a revolutionary, deconstructing the history of art, saying, no, actually, there's a much more democratic understanding of art, and it's not limited to fine art museums or even art schools, art academies.
We're going to have to leave it there, James. I feel our chat was hijacked by time, only time alone. But I would recommend anyone to go and visit the Gallery of Everything. And
I will make you a French 75, which is the drink that the British used in order to combat the giant French ammunition of the last century.
On that note, we've got to leave it. I don't know whether that's a bombshell, but it sounds literally like a bombshell. That's all we've got time for on this edition of Aperitivo. My thanks to special guests Ben Luke, Kenny Schachtevich and Jasper Sharp. Today's show is produced by Tom Edwards and David Michon. Our studio manager here was Jack Phillips, and back in the studio at Midori House, it was Sam Impey. Next up, it's Section D. I think there's lots more on this script to read, but...
I can't be asked.
So I think we'll just wrap it up and let's all go and have some bubbles. James, what are you going to mix for us? Oh, a French 75.
Tout à l'heure.
For the time being, thanks for tuning in.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.